all over the world on this first Sunday in October, people who profess the Christian religion are celebrating what some call communion and some call the Lord's Supper. They do this in many different ways, but the intent is always the same: to commemorate an evening long ago in Jerusalem when a revolutionary young teacher from the small hill town of Nazareth sat in an upper room with his closest friends for a final meal together. We have no record of what the weather was like that night, but we do know about the psychological climate. The host was tired and depressed, convinced by this time that his enemies were implacable and meant to take his life within a few more hours. One of his friends, breaking bread with him around the same table, had already taken a bribe to identify him in the darkness for the soldiers who were planning to arrest him. Now that it all appeared inevitable, the host seemed almost eager to get it over with. "The thing you plan to do," he said to the traitor, "please go ahead and do it quickly." It was the end, or at least it seemed to be the end, of an amazing adventure that had started a short time before. A wandering teacher who became known as Jesus of Nazareth had called a little band of men, most of them fishermen, to the audacious task of starting a movement that would change the world. He must have had remarkable charisma to get them to leave their jobs and join his crusade, because surely few other dreams have ever begun with such poor promise of success. But the beauty of his life and the haunting vision he painted as he taught almost won the day. For a while, it really looked as if the whole country might join in to create a new kingdom of mind and heart and usher in a golden age. Jesus himself was so optimistic at one point that he exclaimed, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven," a figure of speech for his conviction that he and his friends would really conquer the world for justice and mercy. But then certain men of power, religious leaders primarily, began to see that if his way won out, there would no longer be special privileges and power for them. So they badgered the governor, a man named Pilate, about a possible revolution that would annoy Rome. And day by day, toward the end, the crowds following Jesus began to thin out until only a handful were left. At one point, deeply discouraged, he turned to those few and asked, "Will you also leave?" They made a brave answer, but they could not know, even as they made it, that they were only hours away from deserting him altogether. On the night the Christian world honors today, while that ragtag band of disciples sat nervously around a table in a borrowed upper room, listening for footsteps, Jesus suddenly picked up a loaf of rough, home-baked bread and broke it in a symbolic preview of what he knew would happen soon to his own body. and a little later, pouring out a cup of their cheap red wine, he saw his own life being poured out, made a little ritual of it all, and said to his friends, perhaps with discernible anguish in his voice, "When you do this yourselves, from time to time in years to come, do it in memory of me." From something so simple came the great sacrament, honored in one way or another in all Christian churches. Perhaps I should be content to speak of communion only in emotional and inspirational ways, but there are also many things to learn from the history of that ceremony, and I'd like to share some of those. In the first place, for some strange reason which none of us who are fascinated by Christian scripture can explain, when the Gospel of John was written, that writer said not a single word about the little drama of the loaf of bread and the goatskin bottle of wine. He substituted a different story for that final night about how Jesus knelt and washed the feet of his disciples and told them they should do the same for each other, and that unless they did, they would not share in his life. This is strong language, much more insistent than the language about the bread and the wine, but the church generally forgot the foot washing ceremony and turned the table drama into one of the most sacred rituals of the Christian church. A sociologist would call it cultural choice, and I, for one, see nothing wrong with it, but we need to know what we do and what we have done, and we need to be forgiving toward those who do a little picking and choosing of their own when it comes to expressing their faith. Religion is a strange and wondrous business. I look back to the intense fervor of my childhood church, in which we totally ignored the command to wash one another's feet and were amused by those small churches that actually did it, while at the same time we made observance of the Lord's Supper one of the most important proofs of a Christian life. We turned pure logic on its head when we made that decision, and then, making a very weak inference from a single verse in the book of Acts, we insisted that it had to be observed every week, 52 Sundays a year, and we said any church that did it less often forfeited the favor of God. In our legalism, we even offered it again on Sunday evening, just in case somebody had been unable to be with us in the morning, an approach to the original sense of communion that would have amazed the early church. We really had no idea, and no preacher ever bothered to tell us, how changed our ceremony was from that simple meal where Jesus reflected upon his coming death and hoped to be remembered. What had been an actual meal for hungry people, eaten around a rough-hewn table by a bunch of tired and sweaty fishermen, became with us and other churches a sanitized and delicate ritual we would have been appalled to hear someone suggest that we use real wine, the kind Jesus and his friends drank, because total abstinence was part of our unwritten creed, and we would all have been surprised to see a big old brown loaf of home-baked bread on the communion table. In our rural churches, one of the women would bake some flat little squares of bread, but this was inconvenient and led to some quiet clucking about how much better Mrs. Lawing's bread was than Mrs. Stout's. So as we got more sophisticated, we sent a deacon to the grocery store for a box of Manischewitz crackers and a bottle of Welch's grape juice. These were as good people as any I have ever known, but without meaning to, they showed how exclusive and uncharitable denominational pride can make us. It was quite all right for us to substitute commercial bread and grape juice, both a far cry from what Jesus used, but we shuddered at the awful sin of a local Presbyterian minister who said in a radio sermon that the literal elements, the physical elements, didn't matter much really, that it was the spirit of the ceremony that counted, that orange juice and vanilla wafers would serve just as well if we truly meditated on the life of Christ and what that life has meant for the world. In the invincible ignorance of a 12-year-old who thought that only his church had rightly understood the Bible, I shuddered along with the rest and did it again when our castigating preacher told us one day about a strange group known as Quakers who didn't take communion at all, never had grape juice or unleavened bread anywhere in sight. I, who had never met a Quaker, marveled at such callow disregard for proper Sunday morning worship, blissfully unaware that while there was indeed a lot of callowness around, it was mostly in me. I knew nothing at the time about the rich tradition of Quaker worship, of their meditation, of how they commune in silence and honor the Lord of the church without the use of any physical elements at all. Theirs was another way, different from mine, and so it was wrong. And there, in a nutshell, is the tragic blindness of creedalism and legalism in religion. In this place, free to choose, remembering that Jesus said, only as often as you do this, without prescribing frequency, we have this ceremony at present twice a year, knowing that some would like it more often, and a few wouldn't mind if we never did it at all. We try to make it as simple and unpretentious as possible. And we remind you that it depends for any meaning or merit on the way you take it. I am not a priest who blesses it and turns it into something else. You end up with a crumb of bread and a drop of juice, but the hope is that you swallow more than food and drink, that by an act of will, you think of the millions of others who do this today, and the one they honor, and what this family and this place mean to you. So in these next few moments, find the sacred in the simple. Lift up your hearts, and let us together join others around the world in this expression of our faith.